Today on Against the Grain, racial health disparities in the U.S. cry out for attention, but according to Catherine Bliss, the root causes of such disparities are not being adequately investigated. I'm C.S. The UC San Francisco-based sociologist describes how genetic science, despite a growing emphasis on race, has not effectively addressed the racial health divide. Coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Some people in this country are less healthy than others, and much of that has to do not with genetics, but with environmental factors, with where and how people live, and how they are regarded and treated by healthcare professionals. Race and racism play a role in that, in how likely people are to live in poverty, or to live in areas with high pollution levels, or to be given lower quality health care. As Catherine Bliss has pointed out, genetic science has been increasingly influenced by calls to address racial disparities and inequality. And so one might hope that scientists in that field have begun investigating the social and structural factors that generate health disparities along racial lines. Catherine Bliss has been investigating this issue for some time. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of Race Decoded: The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. She also, and this will be our focus today, contributed a chapter about genetics and health disparities to the new volume Subprime Health: Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. In that chapter, Bliss writes that notions of race and health disparities have been increasingly biologized, and redress for social inequality has been re-envisioned in the form of pills and diagnostics. When Catherine Bliss joined me recently in studio, I asked her when the U.S. government took on, as she has written, the conviction that it was morally indebted to racial minorities for all those years and decades of abuse and neglect.
This change really started happening in the 80s. You see, in 1980, the Surgeon General's report starts to focus on racial minorities and health disparities. And by 1986, so, you know, further along into the 80s, you actually have the term health disparities being used by the government and increasingly by public health officials. And from 86 into the early 90s, it became a real focus of biomedicine as well, but especially of public health. So it starts with the Surgeon General's report, and then it starts to move into the public health department as a whole, and then it becomes the focus of public health efforts in biomedical research. So the change mostly happened in the 80s and then really took on new life in biomedicine in the 1990s, especially the early 90s.
And when you say health disparities, what are we talking about?
Initially, health disparities referred to just a kind of vague sense of differences in the ways that Blacks and whites were treated and the kind of health care they were getting and also the different disease rates. So it was a little bit more vague in the beginning. And later on, as health disparities research became a thing, and it was really something that was taken up by social epidemiologists and medical sociologists and medical, social scientists who study medicine, then you start to see a lot more of the specificities of, you know, what aspects of healthcare delivery are responsible for disparities. So not just something like, oh, well, there are differences in cancer rates between Blacks and whites, but now you get to, especially towards the early 90s when it became a big part of the public health initiative to do something about health disparities and they start using the language of eradicate health disparities in policy, in fact, and in grant mechanisms. So kind of money being offered to researchers to do new research on new topics. So around then, you start to see this kind of shift towards specificities of what kind of care is not being given, or what kind of treatment is being given differentially. And so that's the kind of shift that you see from the 80s to the 90s.
So, for example, healthcare providers, depending on the race of their patient, they may act differently. They may treat this person differently.
Correct, yes. And give different drugs and give different, you know, therapies, allocate medication differently. For example, one current disparity is in pain medication, the prescription of pain medication. And again, I keep on going back and forth about blacks and whites, but that was how the focus was initially and has continued to be. But now we have a lot more research that looks across all racial groups. And health disparities, there is a great deal of research that focuses on male-female health disparities, but a lot of the focus is on racial health disparities, in the sense that many times when people notice the difference between male and female disease rates or care differentials, there's a certain naturalized kind of view that this is because males and females are sexually different. And so when we use the term health disparities, most of the time it's focusing on racial health disparities.
Many people have heard about the Human Genome Project, which was launched in 1986. To what extent were scientists with this project, at least initially, interested in or focused on health disparities and racial disparities?
In the beginning, the Human Genome Project was not focused on racial health disparities or really interested in studying anything that had to do with racial differences. And the project launched in 1986, so it was kind of coming about at the same time as health disparities research was coming about. And initially, the project was kind of a basic science look at the genome, and leaders didn't make as many promises about the public health benefits of genomics. It was more like curiosity about what the genome was.
Right. It's about sequencing the genome, mapping the genome.
Exactly. Yes. And so what they did was the project really just collected DNA from any sources that it could collect DNA from. And it looked for the most robust sources of DNA within what they had collected. And they used the technology of the time to just stitch together a genome from many different sources. And so where, you know, what type of human that came from was not of interest in the beginning. It was just whatever they could do to create the human genome, a complete genome.
And that, to me, suggests that the assumption was that different populations are kind of interchangeable, are equal in certain ways.
Correct. Yes. The human genome mappers, these scientists who were leading the project, they really had this belief that everybody was essentially the same, that we were so similar, in fact, to our primate cousins, you know, that you could take any human on Earth and you could create a genome from their genome, and it would be representative of what we were looking for, which is, what is a human, you know, what is a human like? What is a genome? But what happened is, you know, of course, the project started in 1986, but the project didn't end until 2003, in fact. And it really started to wrap up in the year 2000. So what you have is the beginning of the project, you know, being pretty much not interested in anything to do with race. And then as the public health initiative around health disparities grew within all of, you know, these different biomedical institutions, and this is something that I focus on so closely in terms of the U.S., but you can see this happening in the other governments that were involved in the Human Genome Project, because it wasn't just a United States project, right? Although it was based mostly in the U.S., but, you know, DNA was taken from all over the world, and it was a partnership of many, many governments. So you can see the same kind of thing of this increasing interest in health disparities. And then you see the project itself starting to take on the language of health disparities and also of race specifically. So in the mid 90s, in 1993, in fact, there was this really monumental shift in policy. NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health, the main, you know, research funder and research entity of the United States that looks at public health and health research, the NIH created a policy around using a specific set of racial categories in order to do good research, good science. And so from then on, you see the Genome Project, the Human Genome Project, and the other genome projects that started to crop up around that time, starting to use the same kind of emphasis on using racial categories, thinking about sampling by race and making sure that all of the different racial groups are included and represented. And then what happens from there is an actual focus on separate racial groups within each project.
Catherine Bliss is her name. She is an associate professor of sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's author of the book Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. And we are talking about some of the research in that book, as well as what she has conveyed in a chapter she contributed to the volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. Her chapter is called The Meaning of Health Disparities. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, speaking of looking kind of at the diversity and the racial diversity of genomes and genetic makeups, the Human Genome Diversity Project was launched in 1991. So what was this project about?
This Human Genome Diversity Project was actually launched as kind of a follow-up project. It would be a way to complete the Human Genome Project by looking specifically at ethnic groups. In 1991, you know, this is early in this kind of new public health initiative to understand health disparities, the project was another international project, another group of different governments coming together to do genomic research and to map human genomes. But this one was vaguely interested in creating some kind of representation of different populations. So the founders of this project were saying, you know, we need to see representation of all of the diversity of the planet. And we don't know that this project that was just launched is going to get at that. So what we want to do is make sure by going to specific places on the planet and making sure to get those genomes. And then we'll also create a repository of these different genomes. And then researchers will be able to, you know, mail in for samples, for DNA samples, and they'll be able to do research that can focus specifically on different groups and different ethnic backgrounds. And so that project started in, as you said, 1991. And in 1993, again, when the National Institutes of Health, you know, instated the policy that it instated to make sure that researchers were using racial categories, specifically the government's racial categories, their set of, you know, five racial categories or four racial categories in one ethnic group. At that point, the Human Genome Diversity Project also started to use the language of the government's health disparities initiative. So they started to talk about getting specifically African Americans involved in the project. And what you see is this move away from just, you know, ethno-linguistic kind of groups. We're going to go around the planet to specifically, we want to make sure that American minorities are included in genomic research.
And how does that accord with at least my understanding, that race has proved not to be kind of biologically based, and that it's more of a social construction. And so that, and if that is true, then that would suggest that the genomes of different races might not really show much variation.
That's a really good question. Actually, the problem that came up was that the researchers who were leading these genome projects were also making a lot of public statements, increasingly so, where they were saying, especially into the end of the 1990s and around the publication of the Human Genome Draft Map in 2000, saying that the genomes showed that race was a fiction. It was a social reality, but not a biological reality, and that you couldn't just carve up the human, you know, all of the diversity in the world into these racial categories, especially the ones that the governments use. But what was confused in this whole kind of attempt to adhere to the new policies was that research inclusion became such a focus that the same researchers who were saying there is no such thing as biological race, there is no genetic race, were increasingly also arguing for using these specific categories in research. You know, and so what happened was, and this is something that my book Race Decoded really looks at, is that by the early 2000s, using the racial categories of the government, which are largely continental race categories. So they refer back to continental races. By the early 2000s, using a kind of continental schematic for including people into the research endeavor or, you know, into new studies and new projects, that became completely, you know, done in terms of these continental groups. And the whole idea of keeping race out of the mix of genetic research and the new genomics just fell by the wayside.
You also address in your writing this issue of racialized medicine, race-based medicine, and medicine that is offered and distributed and marketed to people of certain races and not others. So Bidal was a drug. And can you tell us about what the makers of this drug intended with it and what they did in the clinical trial stage?
Sure. So Bidal was a heart failure drug, is a heart failure drug, in fact, that was created to reduce the pill burden, what's called the pill burden of taking a couple of pills that help in preventing heart failure. So normally you would go to your doctor if you're at risk for heart failure, and your doctor might prescribe you these two generic drugs. They're two different pills, and the makers of Bidal came in and said, we're going to put them both into one pill, and it's going to help, you know, reduce your risk for heart failure. So what happened is the FDA did not approve this drug application. So they didn't approve Bidal for use by all populations. But the makers of Bidal noticed that in their clinical trials that African Americans were helped a great deal. And there are a lot of details about the ways in which they compared blacks and whites that were kind of fuzzy and funny and don't match up at all. The numbers don't match up. So really, the truth is that the drug does help people of all backgrounds, not just African Americans, but with no approval from the FDA for that specific use and a patent that was about to be over. What happened is the makers decided to conduct a new clinical trial that was focused on African Americans to show efficacy and to say, we're going to prove that this is great for African Americans, and we're going to have a new application that's just going to say we're selling this just to African Americans. And it was successful because the drug works in everybody. So they got a new lease on the patent, you know, and then they got approval in 2005 from the FDA. So what happened is race-based medicine became a reality. The actual way that they recruited African Americans for their study, for their clinical trial, was by self-report. So people just, you know, came and said, I identify as African American. There was no kind of, you know, some genetic testing or any kind of population research. It was just, you know, people saying, I'm Black. I identify as Black. That was the language they used. And so it worked in those people who were deemed Black or mm-hmm. African American. And then the makers, Nitromed, they actually got approval to sell this to African Americans. And actually, there were some follow-up interviews and conversations with people who were a part of the study, and some people had changed their racial affiliation, so no longer identified as Black. So that's, you know, it just shows that self-identification is something that is important. You know, you have to let people identify themselves, but at the same time, it's not a surefire thing that what you're getting is exactly what you're saying. And then what happened is race-based medicine became something that became normal for the FDA and for biomedicine in general. And there have been other drugs, many drugs, that have also tried to kind of rescue themselves by taking a race-based tack. So saying this drug, which did not get approval, will work specifically in this subpopulation. And the FDA has been, and the U.S. Patent Office has been pretty generous about approving those race-based drugs. So we have many more race-based drugs out there on the market now.
Is Bidil still on the market?
Bidil is, yeah.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Catherine Bliss joins me in studio. She teaches sociology at UC San Francisco. She is author again of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. Her research explores the sociology of race, gender, and sexuality in science, medicine, and society. And we're talking specifically about a chapter she contributed to a new volume. It's called Subprime Health. It's edited by Nadine Ellers and Leslie Hinkson. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. What have some bioethicists been pushing for in the area of race-based drugs and medicine?
Most of the conversation around the bioethics of race, and this includes race-based medicine, whether to have race-based medicine, whether to prescribe it, whether to promote it, has been around getting people treatment. And so what the standard conversation has focused on is, you know, making sure that health disparities are eliminated by any means necessary, and especially by making sure that racial minorities get the drugs that they need. And so there hasn't been a lot of critical discussion about race-based medicine and about what these companies have been doing as far as rescuing drugs that they otherwise would not be able to sell. And so now we have a few conversations popping up around the country about with a critical perspective, including the volume that we're talking about today, the Subprime Health book. And in that volume, we're a bunch of scholars looking critically at the quick fixes that are being thrown at racial health disparities and all kinds of problems and inequalities having to do with health by race.
Yeah, I mean, some people would be encouraged by this news about racially targeted medicine, about the inclusion of a certain consciousness of race difference in genetic projects, genome sequencing, genetic research. What is your concern? What is your critique around these kinds of issues, which do seem to be moving in a progressive direction because race seems to be more and more of an issue, something to take into consideration, something to implement within these projects?
My issue is with using racial inclusion into studies and projects as a solve for racial health disparities. What happens when you do that is you get all of these studies and projects being stratified by race. And when researchers, so they create these big databases or genomic repositories, cell repositories. And what they do is they create these databanks where researchers from all over the world can, you know, send in for actual DNA samples from which to do their studies. And when those researchers do their studies, they get these samples packaged by race. And so what they end up doing is comparing these by whites or by blacks, or doing studies that are focused on one particular race, and that racializes their research. Even if they don't have a real racial motive, you know, and they're not necessarily studying something that has a racial health disparity or shows disparate rates, their research becomes racialized. And so the problem that I see is that, you know, just including by continental categories, which genome scientists have repeatedly noted don't really get at the diversity on the planet and are not a good way to think about genomic diversity.
So these categories are Caucasian, Black, Asian, and I guess Latino, oh no, Hispanic would be that ethnic category. And then we're talking about Native Americans as well.
Yes, yes. Those are the categories. And again, they're kind of by continent. So you can think of it as, you know, the African continent, the European continent, the Asian continent. Of course, you know, those are one big continent. But anyways, you know, that's the breakdown. And so what happens is you get these comparisons by continent, and then you don't get any attention to the actual root causes of health disparities, root causes such as differential health care, treatment, or something that I think is even more important as a sociologist, the actual social and built environment, because there are reasons why, you know, there are environmental reasons why some people are going to have higher rates of cancer and why they're going to have more aggressive cancers. And that has to do with where you live, the water, the air that you have around you, not just the kind of healthcare you have access to, but also just, you know, your living and working conditions. Those things are your everyday life. They're what you live on a daily basis. And so to have that not be in the mix of a study that ends up reproducing a sense of difference, but now difference that is genetic or genomic, I think that's really dangerous and it's irresponsible.
Well, you would think that with the emerging focus on race and the compulsion, right? The federal authorities are saying, use these categories and look at race and look at racial disparities in your research. You would think then that this research, or at least some of it, would be devoted to the causes of health disparities, like you're saying, the social, environmental, built-in environmental causes of why people, some people are in better health statuses and some people aren't. So is there kind of a lot of research being devoted to not just the straight genomic, medical, biological stuff, but also to the environmental causative stuff that you think as a sociologist they should be interested in large part, in a significant way?
Yes, there is a great deal of research that focuses on the social and environmental causes and factors that contribute to health disparities, but that research is not a part of the genomic endeavor. And what I look at is this new science that is, it's not so new anymore, but it is increasingly prominent and predominant in public health. Genomic research gets the lion's share of funding from all of the different American funding sources. And when you look at the governments around the world that have taken part in genomic research, from those governments as well. So it's a very capital intensive area of research and it gets a lot of money. And so when we look at what is being spent on these different forms of research, genomics is getting way more money than social research, and way, way, way more money. You know, so the issue is that this science that is increasingly coming to stand for what's great about public health and what American public health is doing for its people, it is headed in this direction that is racializing and that is creating a more fixed sense of biological differences on like a continental schematic or a continental axis of difference. It's been a trend for social scientists who are interested in health disparities to pair up with genome researchers and to try to get on some of these studies to get some of the funds and to try to understand health disparities from a gene environment perspective. But that hasn't changed the fact that research inclusion is really what genome scientists are doing here by race. And any social epidemiological research that comes as a part of these studies is limited.
That's Catherine Bliss, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. Again, author of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with her about health disparities and genomics and racialized medicine. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Catherine Bliss is a sociology professor based at the University of California, San Francisco. She's got a forthcoming book due out in 2018 called Social by Nature, The Promise and Peril of Sociogenomics. And we are talking about a chapter, although much of her research has focused on what we are chatting about this hour. The chapter is entitled The Meaning of Health Disparities, and she contributed it to the new volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. So it seems like in today's culture, biomedicine kind of holds us in thrall, right? We are told about all these wonderful advances in science and medicine and how it can improve our lives, and wow, there's this new medicine for that, and you know, in some senses, these medicines and some of these treatments are considered, are marketed, are presented as quick fixes to our problems. So do you think that's part of the reason why social science and sociological research and social epidemiology is lagging behind, doesn't get the funding, doesn't get the attention that genomics and kind of straight medical research into genetic sequencing and the like gets?
Definitely. The issue with doing something about the social and built environment is that it is expensive. I mean, you can't just fix the fact that African Americans live in worse living conditions and have worse working conditions on average compared to white Americans. And you can't just fix neighborhoods that have been deprived of good food and deprived of, you know, clean water. These are the most difficult things for governments to fix. Of course, you would hope that they would fix them, but, you know, they're expensive. It's a lot cheaper just to throw pills at people and say, here, your genome looks like this, and so why don't you just take this pill and, you know, stay in your, you know, subprime living conditions and stay in that job that is dangerous for your health and just take this pill and you'll, you know, that's so much cheaper. It's so much easier to do something like that. So I think that there needs to be a national and then hopefully international conversation about these problems. And I want to stress that the people who are doing something about racial disparities and trying to include more groups into science, they have the best intentions. It's not that you have people who are trying to do something bad or, you know, or actually think like, yeah, let's just throw pills at the problems. You know, it's more like this is a big, it's a structural problem, and it's a big web work of different institutions and organizations that for various reasons, they have an interest in using the government's racial categories, either by policy mandate or also from interest in doing something about the problem and inadvertently recreating an issue of stratifying by race in a way that later, as I was mentioning, leads to the comparison and kind of a just non-critical look at race being something that's just genetic.
In your work, you've documented some of the conversations between sociologists of race and genetic scientists. So you have these people, and there is a dialogue, right? There are conversations going on. Sociologists are trying to tell these scientists what they might want to focus on or prioritize in their work. Do you get the sense that anything is coming of that in a constructive way, that some of the ideas that people like UC Berkeley's Troy Duster are trying to relate to these people and inform these people about is having an impact on their social consciousness, political consciousness, scientific work?
Definitely, there's an impact, and people like Troy Duster and increasingly I also take part in a lot of conversations with biomedical researchers and genome mappers that are making an impact. So these conversations are creating a consciousness around it. But the outcome of genomic research is going to be focused on the body. So it's going to be things like drugs, drug development. And, you know, even gene environment research, which promises to look at the interaction between genes and the environment, most studies do not have any kind of analysis of environmental factors, anything beyond the body. So sometimes a study will say, well, we took into account the person's body mass index or their weight or their how many times they ate meals or something like that. And that's considered the environment. There's nothing about people's living conditions, people's working conditions. And another thing that is really pertinent to health disparities, you know, racism. So, you know, that while many genome scientists who have, genome mappers, in fact, the leaders of these projects who have said, you know, we want to understand race better, have also talked about their interest in understanding the biology of racism, that's not really their area that they focus on. So there hasn't been research on that, you know, on gene environment, genomics of racism and all of that. And yeah, the environment keeps being limited to these kinds of easy to ascertain kind of height, weight, health choices, health behaviors, and not the built environment or the relationships that people have and their actual daily life conditions.
What does epigenetics mean, and how is that different from genetics? And does epigenetics research have any promise in terms of elucidating the kind of environmental and social factors you would like to see incorporated into research?
Epigenetics looks at the genetic material that is outside of the genome. So genes are actually comprised of nucleotides. And nucleotides, there are billions of nucleotides in our genome. So like they say about 3.2 billion nucleotides in the entire length of the genetic material in your body. Genes actually are little fragments within all of that whole structure. string of material, right? They're kind of these little islands of genetic material that code for proteins. That's why people have focused on that genetic material as opposed to every single base pair, every single nucleotide that's in our bodies, because those genes actually code for proteins. And we know a lot about proteins. So we know, like, okay, if we develop a drug that inhibits the making of this protein, then, you know, we're going to help with this particular disease or disorder. So for a long time, scholars thought that that other material in the genome, or in, you know, the entire 3.2 billion nucleotides, that other stuff was junk, and they called it junk DNA. And that is referred to as the epigenome, because it's, you know, not the genes specifically, but it's all the other stuff. And what they found is that it's actually a great deal responsible for the turning on and off of genes. So that's called gene regulation and gene expression. So whether genes are expressed or not. So the other thing that researchers have found is that so-called junk DNA is responsive to the environment, like actually responsive to what you're doing and what kind of care you're getting and what you're eating and how you're sleeping and all of that. So we might have the same genes in our bodies, in our cells, and the same genes are supposed to be making the same proteins, but what ends up happening is mine are turned off in some cells and, you know, yours are turned on in those cells, and then you get these differences. So now there's this move to study the epigenome and to understand how the environment is impacting what our DNA actually does to us. And the issue I find with epigenomics or epigenetics is that it is also still very focused only on the genetic material, on DNA. And whereas it has this promise of understanding how the environment impacts us, most studies just focus on the process of turning on and on off genes, which is called methylation. And so basically they focus on this process and there is no environmental analysis. So this area that's called, it falls under the umbrella of this exciting new focus on genes in their environments, or gene environment research, is not really environmental research at all. It's just genetic research. It's more genetic research. So that's the issue with epigenomics.
That's Catherine Bliss. She teaches sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's the author of Race Decoded, and she contributed a chapter entitled The Meaning of Health Disparities to the volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. We turn now to one of the editors of Subprime Health. Leslie Hinkson is an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University. I spoke with Leslie just before airtime, and I asked her what that volume, which she co-edited with Nadine Ehlers, is basically about.
Well, at its most fundamental level, Subprime Health is actually about thinking about what people have been calling race-based medicine, and trying to sort of conceptualize and operationalize it in what we think of as a much more thorough way. So many times when people think about race-based medicine, they only think about, you know, things like ethnopharmacogenics. So, you know, people creating a drug that is designed specifically for one particular racial or ethnic group, which, you know, many people don't know that this is happening or has happened, but it is, and it's seen as perhaps a wave of the future. We think of it beyond that. You know, it's more than just a little pill. You know, it's also the ways in which different types of people, different types of bodies are treated, you know, in the medical encounter. So it also has to do with, you know, how your doctor treats you. You know, it talks about things like how, you know, doctors are trained to diagnose different types of people differently and treat them, give them different treatments based on their racial identity or what is thought of as their racial identity, you know. And then from there, it's also just the whole healthcare delivery system. You know, we know in this country that, you know, medicine has been rationalized and been rationed along racial lines since the institutionalization of medicine. So that's really what prompted this book, is, you know, trying to think about this in an interdisciplinary fashion and having people that we thought of as doing really innovative things in this area, you know, help us to, in one volume, think about, you know, what is race-based medicine and what are the things we should be most concerned with if we actually do want to try and do things like perhaps, you know, reduce health disparities.
The subtitle of this book is Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. What do you mean by debt in this context?
Yeah, so one of the things that we found when we were thinking about our individual work is that there are multiple ways we could think about debt. So, you know, debt, of course, in its most common form, has to do with monetary debt. So there are a few chapters in the volume that actually deal with monetary debt. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean in a healthcare system that actually does try and treat and diagnose illness along racial lines when race is a biological fiction? You know, how does that actually lead to not only those who are being treated in this fashion going into debt, but also just our whole, you know, system of healthcare delivery actually doing so in such an inefficient way that, you know, we are racking up monetary costs? I mean, if you think about it, this country is probably spends the most on medical care and health care of any other country in the world, and yet, you know, sort of the quality of that care by almost every metric, including mortality and morbidity rates, is actually much lower than you'll see in other developed countries in the world. So there's monetary debt, and there's also, you know, we think about also moral debt. You know, many times when people think about sort of the imperative to actually start, you know, treating different bodies differently at this point in time, it's actually seen as a way to atone for, you know, the past history of medical abuse and medical neglect. And it causes us to think about, well, who owes whom, right, and what is owed. And so, you know, the rest of the volume thinks about things like moral debt and reparative justice and how race-based medicine, you know, in many ways, you know, has been seen as invoking these other kinds of debt as well.
Give me some specifics of some of the other chapters in this volume, what those chapters are about.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I can start with mine. So my chapter actually begins by talking about the subprime mortgage crisis, right? And, you know, that is basically where the title of the volume comes from. One of the things that drove the subprime mortgage crisis, the fact that African Americans and Latinos in particular were actually being, you know, targeted for subprime mortgages, even when their credit scores and their credit histories and their asset-to-debt ratios actually qualified them for prime mortgages, you know, simply because they were just being targeted for their racial and ethnic identities. And that, in large part, is what fueled the subprime mortgage crisis. And my chapter basically says this is actually also part of what is implicit in our rising healthcare costs here, is black and brown bodies are being targeted for treatments that don't necessarily have anything to do with what ails them or what will treat their ailments the best. And I use the example of hypertension. You know, for at least four decades, you know, it's not a secret. Doctors have been saying that African Americans in particular shouldn't be given certain drugs for their hypertension because supposedly they don't respond as well. And so I basically just do an analysis to show the extent to which this is the case, and also analyses to show that this treatment doesn't really follow any sort of logic, you know, whether guidelines that have been around for years or whether, you know, it has to do with whether the drugs are cheaper or not, because perhaps they believe that, you know, because African Americans tend to be lower income, Maybe they don't have health insurance. They can't pay for more expensive drugs, et cetera. So that's one. There's another chapter in there that I co-authored with Ruha Benjamin that looks at trust. You know, and it's based on Ruha Benjamin's field work at a clinic that treats people with sickle cell anemia. And basically, one of the things that she found in her research is that, you know, they're trying to recruit African Americans to be part of these clinical trials for, you know, this cutting edge treatment, but they can't seem to find enough people to participate in the trials. And one of the tropes that is trotted out very often is that, well, these people, you know, what's wrong with them? We're trying to do something good for them. Why do they lack trust? So this idea that African Americans are devoid of this certain value when, you know, and if only they'd learn to trust, you know, which is a very ahistoric view of the history of medicine and experimentation in the United States. And so, you know, why don't the people operating these trials turn it on themselves and say, well, how can we earn the trust of these people that we actually want to have in our studies? I mean, I could go on and on. There's so many great chapters in this book.
In the conclusion to this book, you and Nadine Ehlers write that the problem with race-based medicine is not that it focuses on the biological, but in that it treats race as a possible biological determinant or root cause trigger of disease, as opposed to thinking of race as predicting the amount of exposure to a series of external stimuli that invoke certain biological responses. So what you are saying here is what you are pointing to here is the importance of environmental factors, right, as opposed to focusing specifically on or exclusively on biology?
Exactly. And I think another way to think about it is, you know, instead of trying to find the pathology within these bodies, you know, I think we should be examining the pathology around which certain types of bodies are forced to live within. So it's not these bodies that are pathological. I mean, racism is pathological. Environmental racism is pathological. The imposition of poverty, right, the imposition of hyper-policing on individuals just because of their quote-unquote racial or ethnic identities, that's pathological.
Leslie Hinkson, assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University, and again, she is co-editor with Nadine Ehlers of the new volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. Leslie, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.